Good morning. We're back to hear the case that was continued from yesterday afternoon. Understand both sides are present and ready to get started. Okay. Is there anything we need to take up before we get started?
Nothing from us, Your Honor.
Chip?
No, Your Honor. I appreciate the court's indulgence yesterday.
Well, we appreciate your being back today. So, you want to go ahead and call the case formally, please.
The court will now call Douglas Lynn Kirk versus the state. And may it please the court, Mr. Gary Udishin, to argue for the appellant.
Okay, Gary.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin by just saying that there's three issues in this case, and I'm going to try to touch upon all three of them in my argument today, because all three of them are substantial issues, and they all have interesting legal twists to them. Let me begin by talking about the sufficiency of the evidence. And what our argument is that the evidence was insufficient to prove that Mr. Kirk did not act in self-defense or in defense of property. I understand from my research in this and other cases that finding a case where a court of appeals has found the evidence insufficient on a self-defense type situation is very difficult, but this is an unusual case from a factual standpoint. So if I could just take a minute and just to put it into context. Mr. Kirk was moving from one rental house to another rental house. And he had a friend helping him move. They were at the new house unloading trucks of his items into the house. And a man who apparently lived next door came over and offered to help. And Mr. Kirk accepted his help. He brought two other men over with him to help. That some period of time passed where the five of them were then unloading things into the house. One of the men that had come from next door then left. So there were the two men who ultimately were the deceased in this case, Mr. Kirk and his friend. After they had reached a stopping point on the unloading of his property, they began to drink. And apparently, at least we know that the two deceased had a tremendous amount to drink because their blood alcohol level, both of them, were up around or over 0.30, you know, which is about four times the legal limit for driving. So they were extremely intoxicated. The medical examiner even said on one of these men that had he not been shot and he was doing an autopsy, he would have thought the alcohol killed him because he had so much alcohol in his system. Apparently, at some point in time, Mr. Kirk's friend was leaving. Mr. Kirk stepped outside with his friend, and then he told the other men it was time for everybody to leave, say goodnight to them. Thought they were going to leave, but apparently they didn't. So when Mr. Kirk had stepped outside of his house, his new rental house, with his friend, and then when he turned around to come back in, the other men had stayed in the house and closed the door behind them, and he came in the house. And when he came in the house, it appeared to him that some of his property had been moved around, and he thought that they were trying to steal his property, which apparently, from all indications from the record, that's exactly what they were trying to do. Mr. Kirk was a gun collector, and he had, I believe the record reflects, about 19 firearms in his house that he'd moved over with him to his new house, and they were in different locations in the house. He told the men again that they needed to leave, and they didn't leave, and somewhat of a verbal altercation began where he accused them of trying to steal his property. During the course of the evening, Mr. Kirk and these other men had discussed tattoos, and the other two men had shown Mr. Kirk their tattoos, which were prison tattoos, and they had both told Mr. Kirk that they were on parole after having spent some time in prison. But at this point, the other men did not leave. They got into this altercation when Mr. Kirk accused them of stealing his property and threatened him, basically saying things like, you don't know who we are, you know, we're going to teach you a lesson, that sort of thing. So Mr. Kirk, again, tried to get them to leave. Eventually, what happened was he went back to his bedroom where he had put one of his firearms. The other men were still refusing to leave, and he felt threatened by them because he had firearms all over the house, and he thought they had not only were trying to steal some of his property, but that they had taken some of his firearms, and he felt threatened by them. What happened then was that he stepped out of the bedroom. One of the men was directly following him into his bedroom, and he shot that man. The other man was coming down the hall, and this is not a large house, but the other man's coming down the hall from the other bedroom where other firearms were put when he was moving in. And he wound up shooting both men, and both men died. The question for the jury was whether or not he acted in self-defense in defense of property. The case was tried. The first time it was tried, there was a hung jury. There was no verdict. It was tried the second time, and I don't recall exactly how long, but the jury was deliberating for a lengthy period of time and then sent out a note and said they were having trouble reaching a verdict, that they were hung, which affects the third issue in the case. But on the sufficiency, after they received some additional instructions, they did not reach a verdict on capital murder for the murder of both of these men, but found Mr. Kirk guilty of murder, not capital murder, of the man that was right coming into his bedroom. They didn't reach a verdict on that man, but they found him guilty of the man that was down the hall. And so you had a guilty verdict on one, and then a hung jury on the capital murder, and then a hung jury on the other murder. So that was the facts before the court. The issue is on the self-defense and defense of property is whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not acting in self-defense or in defense of property.
Now that shifting in burden confuses me. Can you go back and walk us through how the burden shifts, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The law is that the defendant has the burden to come forth with some evidence to raise the issue. And once the defendant raises the issue, the burden is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't act in self-defense. So the issue was raised by the defendant's testimony, and the jury was charged on the issue. But then the burden's on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't act in defense of property or in self-defense. And essentially, when you're doing an analysis of the sufficiency of the evidence on these defensive issues, it's not much different than a general sufficiency analysis. What's unusual about this case, and I cited four or five cases in the brief where courts of appeals or the Court of Criminal Appeals has found the evidence sufficient to uphold the jury's rejection of a self-defense. But in all of those cases, there's some facts that are not the type of facts that we have here. Like in one of the cases, the defendant there was testimony the defendant had threatened to kill the other person. In one of them, there was a stab wound. The deceased had a stab wound in his back. In each one of those cases, and invariably when you look at these cases, there's some evidence in the record that contradicts the self-defense that the jury could rationally rely upon to reject the self-defense. Here, there's nothing. Here, all you have is Mr. Kirk's testimony about what happened. There are no other witnesses. His friend had left. The only people in the house when the incident happened were the two men that were killed and Mr. Kirk. And the state's theory about why Mr. Kirk killed these men, it's difficult for me to articulate what that is, because there was no logical, reasonable explanation that could be given or argued by the state as to why Mr. Kirk would kill two perfect strangers in his house unless he felt threatened by them exactly as he testified to. And so what's unusual about this case is that there is no evidence and no theory and no deduction from the evidence that could reasonably be argued to refute the self-defense.
What was the basis of his belief that they were armed?
The fact that he had guns all over the house. He had moved his 19 guns into the house. The men had stayed in his house when he was outside with his friend. The one that he was convicted of killing, the one that was down the hall, was by the other bedroom where he had put several loaded guns. So he believed the other man had gotten one of the loaded guns. So the evidence showed that he had a reasonable belief that they were armed and dangerous, and they threatened him in his own home. So there's just nothing like we have in the other cases where there's some circumstance that the jury could reasonably and rationally rely upon. So that's what's unusual about this case from a sufficiency standpoint.
What evidence is there that they were armed? My recollection is none.
There's not any evidence that they were actually armed. The evidence was his reasonable belief that they were, because of the guns in the house and the threats that they had made to him. He actually, when he was in his bedroom before he stepped out, he fired a couple of warning shots into the closet just to let them know he had a gun, and they continued to come down the hall, which his testimony was gave him even more fear that they were armed, because they didn't seem deterred by the fact that he clearly had a firearm. So it's not that they were armed, but that he had a reasonable belief that they were armed and that they were coming after him, essentially. Let me talk just for a minute about ground two, which is the issue concerning
Let me follow up with one more question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
My recollection is that there was evidence that a rifle had been moved from the living room to the bedroom and back to the living room. What evidence was there besides that there were weapons available to them?
Mr. Kirk's testimony was that he had put some of the weapons in the extra bedroom where the man was coming from towards him. He was in his bedroom with the rifle that he used to shoot the men, and the man that he was convicted of on the murder case was coming from a bedroom where he had put other firearms. So they clearly, under the record, had access to some of his firearms, in addition to the fact that it appeared to him that things had been moved, like at least one of the guns. If there's no other questions on the sufficiency, let me make a couple of comments.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Man we keep talking about who was down the hall, Mr. Pete Dias, was shot twice, once in the thigh and once in the abdomen. Near him was found a beer can where beer had spilled out of it, and there was some evidence that he appeared to have been attempting to crawl away. You agree with that?
I don't really agree with that, Your Honor, and that really goes to the argument that we make in our reply brief, where we cite the Winfrey case. And the Winfrey case, as I'm sure the Court's aware of, came out of the Court of Criminal Appeals a couple of months ago. It's a sufficiency case where they reversed a case based upon sufficiency of the evidence, and they drew a very clear distinction between speculation and reasonable inferences from the evidence. And my position would be that's the state's argument, but that's speculation. That's not a reasonable inference from the evidence, just like they talk about in Winfrey.
Blood on the palm and a print in the blood in the hall that showed a palm print in the direction of being away from the bedroom in which Mr. Kirk was situated. You think it's not a reasonable inference?
I don't believe that it's a reasonable. I think the state takes it further than the evidence justifies. It's not a reasonable inference from that evidence that he was trying to get away, which
I
think
is. Let me get you to focus on one other point. I know your time is drawing nigh.
Well, we can give him more time.
Thank you, Judge. What evidence is there in the record of motive?
There is no evidence in the record of motive at all, which is one of the problems on the sufficiency. There is nothing presented at all as to why Mr. Kirk would kill these men. So the only evidence the jury has is his explanation as to him feeling threatened by them and that they were trying to steal his property.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I'm going to skip round two and make one comment.
No, we'll get you next
okay.
time.
All right.
I'm not going to let you get away with this yet.
All right. Ground two involves. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. You're still on one.
Look on page 14 of your brief, if you would. All right. 931 of the Penal Code. Are we going on 1C murder? Is that where you're hanging your hat on self-defense? Knew or had reason to believe that the person against whom the force was used was committing or attempting to commit murder? I mean, they aren't, you don't have, as I see it, A or B. We're not entering the house. We're already in the house. We're not removing something from the house with force. So that brings us down to 1C was committing or attempting to commit murder?
Well, that would be correct under the defendant's belief, which, of course, you look at it from the defendant's belief, as long as he has a reasonable belief, that he believed the men had firearms, had access to his firearms, and they had threatened him. So he was in fear for his life.
So the answer is yes.
Yes, Your
Murder
Honor.
Is where you're going.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Not robbery?
Well, we have defense of property and self-defense. So we have robbery in the sense that they were using force to get away with the property that they had already gathered together to steal. So I wouldn't say that it's limited to murder, but it's robbery's part of it. This is a mixture of self-defense and defense of property. So you have different versions of it, but when you look at 9.31A, robbery would be part of it because he believed that they had gathered together his property and were in the course of stealing it.
I thought the only thing that had been gathered together was the rifle that he said was in the living room, then was in the bedroom, and then he saw it back in the living room again when he came back in after asking them to leave.
Your Honor, he testified, Mr. Kirk testified, that it appeared that they had moved some of his property. It looked to him like some of the property was not where it was before. He had been told by some other neighbors, or at least one other neighbor, that this house had been broken into several times before. And so he formed a belief that these were the men that had been breaking into the house and stealing property. And the fact that his property appeared to have been moved caused him to believe that they were attempting to steal his property. Now, it didn't become a robbery until he confronted them about it and told them to leave his house, and then he felt like he was being threatened by them physically. But I do think it's a reasonable inference to draw that when they were coming at him, in his reasonable belief, they were coming at him to cause him physical harm, plus to get away with the property they were trying to steal from him. So I do think that robbery would be encompassed within that. I think it's, you know, my focus is on the fact that he was fearful for his life. And that's not to say that he wasn't fearful that they were taking his property, but he was fearful that he was going to be hurt by these men, and he was fearful for his life.
I understand.
The second issue, briefly, concerns pictures taken at his old house by the police that he was moving out of, things like skulls and FTW and and animal, you know, pieces of animals and things that just sort of made him look bad to try to make him look like somebody who was dangerous or different as far as the jury goes. And there was an objection on relevance of that and a 403 objection. And I think it's clear that that evidence had nothing to do with this offense. The state's real argument on that is, I believe it's 38.36 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, is that it somehow goes to show his state of mind at the time of the offense, which there's just really no factual connection between whatever he had at his other house on the wall and what was going on here during this incident where these men got killed.
Why don't you talk about harm, though? I'm hearing you. Well, about relevance, probative value, but what about harm? If it's so off the wall, no pun intended, then how is it harm?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, obviously the state thought it was harmful because they fought to get it in and got it in, number one. Second of all, this was obviously a close case. The jury was hung the first time. Second time, they did not reach a verdict on the killing of one of the men. And thirdly, it just goes to make it just sort of it, and I think I said this in the brief, it's designed to dehumanize him, to make him seem different than everybody else, that he has these weird things in his house and he, you know, has like something to do with a demon, and just to get the jury to not view him in the same way that they would view somebody else. So it's harmful because this was obviously a close case and they're trying to paint him as something that the jury would find distasteful. And if I could just have a couple of minutes, I want to just talk about this jury charge issue. The supplemental jury charge issue was essentially the jury instructions. So you had a capital murder for the killing of both men, then you had separate counts for the killing of each individual man. The original jury instructions told the jury to deliberate on count one and then reach a verdict on count one, and if they found him not guilty on count one, then to move on to count two and three. The jury deliberated, as I said earlier, for a lengthy period of time, sent out two notes saying they were hung. The judge gave them an Allen charge, and then eventually they sent out another note saying that they were hopelessly deadlocked and they understood the consequences of it from having received the Allen charge. The court gave a supplemental jury instruction, then changing that initial instruction, the initial instruction being deliberate on, make a decision on count one, and then you can move on to count two and three, saying that they didn't have to make a decision on count one. If they were unable to make a decision, then they could move on to count two and three. There was a proper objection from defense counsel on that. And what this really boils down to is the Code of Criminal Procedure is very specific about when supplemental instructions can be given. And it says they can be given when there's improper argument of counsel. Nobody claims that that applies here.
I think we all agree that the rule says what the rule says and you can't do it. But
right.
When you read these cases, how do you – it's like, well, the rule says you can't, but
okay, the
we're bound by the cases, of course.
The Roberson case from this court, which is the state's – what the state primarily relies upon – makes it clear in the Roberson case that the court is approving of the supplemental instruction because the jury sent out a note asking for additional instructions. So that fits right in to 36.16. It was important in that case in Roberson, the court distinguished the Moore case from one of the Houston Court of Appeals where there was a reversal, and they said the difference was in the Moore case, the jury had not sent out a note asking for additional instructions. So where the state really comes down to on this is to argue that the jury sending out a note saying that they're hung is the equivalent of asking for additional instructions like you saw in Roberson. And first of all, it's not what saying hung means. There's a case that we cited In our brief, the Garza case, I believe, is from the Corpus Christi court, where the jury sent out a note saying they were hung, and then the court gave some additional instructions, and they found that that was error. The saying that a jury saying we're deadlocked or we're hung is not the type of note that the courts, this court and others, have found to be a request for additional instructions. And the Moore case said specifically that, I'm paraphrasing this, but it said specifically that the courts of Texas have never allowed a supplemental instruction in violation of the specific rules of 3616 when there was an objection and it was harmful to the defendant, which is exactly what we have here. Some of these cases that the state cites, and when you look in this area of the law, sometimes you see cases where there's no objection. And then there's sort of a glossing over the fact that there's no objection. But I think the Roberson case, and I would expect that the court would find that to be the most persuasive authority, since it's this court's authority. Under the Roberson case doesn't help the state here, because they make it very clear, you make it very clear, that there has to be a request from the jury for an additional instruction.
And you think that, if you are correct on that, that you would be entitled to an acquittal instead of a new trial? You asked, I gathered from your brief, you were asking for an acquittal based on any and all of your three issues.
Well, that's not, I may have inartfully drafted that. I mean, obviously we're asking for an acquittal on the sufficiency issue. I don't believe we're entitled to an acquittal on the other issues.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Your
Honor. Let me ask you this. Suppose the judge had given the additional jury charge but allowed the lawyers to argue.
I mean, I suppose that could have something to do with the harm analysis, but that's not what happened.
No, but if...
You know, and I mean, I don't think that makes it okay. I don't think that makes it okay. It's still in violation of 3616, but I think if he allowed them to give additional argument, it might ameliorate some of the harm.
Then we'd be in a different posture.
Perhaps, because on the harm. I'm not sure we really would in this case, though, because our argument is that this was an instruction that should not have been given, and it's clear that had it not been given, you would have had a hung jury rather than a verdict of guilty. And one point that the defense lawyer made, which I think is important, is that the defense lawyer said, if I was asking for an additional instruction that I didn't ask for before, the court would say I waived it. And so why isn't this a waiver on the part of the state? They didn't ask for this instruction until they had a jury that was essentially hung. And why isn't it a waiver on the part of the state? Separate and apart from the fact that it's just not in compliance with the statute. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
We want to make your trip here worth it.
Yes.
Chip.
May it please the court. The state has to take issue with defense's characterization of the standard on review for self-defense. The state does not have the burden, did not have the burden at trial, nor does it have on appeal the burden to disprove the defense of self-defense. That's in the Saxton case cited in the state's brief, where the Court of Criminal Appeals addressed that very issue and rejected any contention that the state bears a burden to disprove the defense of self-defense. The way it works is the state has a burden to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant has a burden to bring forth some evidence to support a self-defense claim. Then the burden of persuasion shifts to the state, for the state to establish the crime, the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, and persuade the jury to reject the defense of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. As this court itself defined the burden in both Smith and Dotson, both cited in the state's brief.
What does that mean as a practical matter?
I
understand you have the burden of proof to prove all of your elements beyond
correct.
A reasonable doubt. And he's
yes.
raised some elements of self-defense, no question about that. So now what is your burden with respect to his self-defense?
Practically, it means exactly what the Court of Criminal Appeals said in Saxon, and I'm going to quote. Defensive evidence which is merely consistent with physical evidence of the scene of the alleged offense will not render the state's evidence insufficient, since the credibility determination of such evidence is solely within the jury's province, and the jury is free to accept or reject defensive evidence. So the state must prove its own case and must at least argue and put on any additional evidence it may need to persuade the jury to reject the defense of self-defense. And if that means simply attacking the credibility of, say, the defense's sole witness, then the state is and indeed should raise evidence and point out inconsistencies to the jury in persuading it to reject the defense of self-defense.
Well, all I recall, and you correct me if my memory is failing me, all I recall that you put on to disprove his self-defense argument was the location of a beer can and some timing. That was it. And you kind of drew a conclusion about, well, he must have had a beer can in his hand. He wouldn't have been running down the hall to attack somebody if he had a beer in his hand. And then there was something about the time.
I disagree. That's not the only evidence. And
okay.
I think the most key evidence was the fact that he didn't report the murders / self-defense killings for at least 12, perhaps as long as 18 hours, depending on which timeline you use. Okay. Moreover, he spoke to at least 5, maybe 6 people between when the assaults, when the murders occurred, and when he was finally arrested. And in that whole time, he never reported to anyone that they'd attempted to rob him, that he had been forced to shoot them, that he feared for his life, or anything else. Indeed, I think some of the most persuasive testimony was from Ms. Thompson, who was a neighbor who knew him for 9 or 10 years, I believe the record reflects. And she testified that he showed up at her doorstep at 5 o'clock in the morning, obviously very scared, disoriented, agitated, and all he kept repeating was, "I'm scared, I'm scared." Never asked her to call the police, never asked for her to call 911, never even asked if he could come in the house, although he was supposedly afraid that people would chase him. That's what he testified to. And I think his failure to do that, and moreover, he also fled the scene twice. The first time under his own testimony when he thought he was being attacked and leaped out the window, and the second time when he went back to the house, found the dead bodies again with another witness, with Cody White, and without saying anything, without calling the police, without notifying any of the authorities, without even ascertaining whether they still may have been alive or not, although judging from the amount of blood on the floor and walls, it was pretty clear they were dead. Nevertheless, what he did was he told Isabel Diaz, "I don't know where they are, I'm not even sure who you're talking about," locks up his house and drives away. I think that, coupled with some of the other physical evidence found in the house, is very persuasive evidence that his contention, his testimony, should be disbelieved by the jury. And as I said, as this court itself has said, standard of review is an appellate court asks whether, after viewing all the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the charged offense beyond a reasonable doubt, and could also have found against appellant on the self-defense issue beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, appellant makes
and could have found against the beyond
could
a
have
reasonable
found.
Doubt.
Correct. And appellant touched on it here in oral argument, but particularly in his reply brief, complains the state's speculation by the use of the phrase "could have found," but that was simply a rhetorical device used by the state in its brief to hearken back to keep repeating what the standard of review is, whether they could have found. Yes, there is a necessary element of speculation in there, but we can't prove it because of 606B. Nevertheless, if you interpret the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, most favorable to the prosecution, then the jury could have rationally rejected his defense. Moreover, they could have rationally rejected it simply because they didn't believe him. They didn't find him to be credible, regardless of what physical evidence there may have been or other gaps in his testimony. And I think that's what Saxon emphasizes particularly. If all you have is the evidence consistent with the physical evidence, and it's up to the jury to believe or disbelieve the defendant, then it's up to the jury to do that. And the evidence isn't sufficient because they reject his testimony. Saxon, in fact, although it's not on all fours on the facts, a good example of what the state's driving at here. In Saxon, the defendant claimed that he and a friend went over to their house. They had some drinks. They began to talk about an ex-girlfriend that they'd both had at one time or another. Defendant testified that the victim became more and more agitated, more and more threatening, got up and started pacing around. He further testified that he went and got a pistol that he had to protect himself, but also to coax, I think is the word he might have used, the victim to leave his house. The victim refused to go. Finally, he said the victim lunged at him over a coffee table, I believe it was, and either tried to knock the coffee table out of his way or actually bumped his knee on it. And the victim, in fear for his life, shot him. It's the only testimony they had. All the other evidence was that the state had evidence that the gun was his, you know, the usual pounds per pressure, the angle of the gun and everything else. The Court of Appeals reversed the conviction, saying the jury should not have rejected the self-defense claim. And the Court of Criminal Appeals came back and said, no, it was up to the jury, and the jury could believe or disbelieve the defendant's testimony that he was acting in self-defense and that this is how it occurred, and they affirmed the conviction.
Well, time-wise, when was that in relation to the change in the Castle Doctrine?
I'm sorry?
Time-wise, when was Saxon in relation to the change in the Castle Doctrine?
Saxon is it was the very first case on the whole burden of persuasion, and I can find out in just a second.
In relation to the Castle Doctrine change?
Saxon is a 1991 case, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's pre.
It's post. If what you're asking is post new penal code, yes, it is. And in fact, that's what the issue came up. A lot of cases interpreting the old penal code had said that the state's burden of proof has a burden of disprove the defense of self-defense. Then with the new penal code, the Court of Criminal Appeals addressed the issue in Saxton and concluded that under the new penal code, the state doesn't bear that burden.
But that was still during the duty to retreat.
I'm sorry?
Still during the time when there was a duty to retreat.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
What?
And, of course, other courts have since then reaffirmed that, particularly this court in Smith and Dotson are the two most recent self-defense cases out of this court that I'm aware of.
Okay, what is your theory of motive? Why in the world would he go back and shoot off in the closet and then go out the back window like somebody's after him? Why would he just shoot two people down other than he's afraid?
First, I'd like to address the fact that it is not an elemental fact. The state is not required to prove motive. And the fact that we may or may not have proved motive, while it may be persuasive to the jury and it may be an evidentiary fact that could prove the elemental fact, we weren't required to prove it. Having said that, the state's theory of the case was that the defendant, because of excessive alcohol use and either methamphetamine or amphetamine use, suffered from severe paranoid delusions. And that because of these paranoid delusions, he believed that he was being attacked and acted in self-defense. They put on some evidence that he admitted to methamphetamine use over a period. And they further put, and the defendant himself admitted that he had been drinking that night. And they put on an expert to testify as to the effects of long-term alcohol and methamphetamine abuse and how it can create paranoid delusions, and the effects of alcohol can lower inhibitions so that people more likely act on feelings or intentions that they might not ordinarily. Other than that, the state had no clear motive, and it is a motiveless crime. But that also goes to why the state, in point of error two, why the state's evidence was, the state maintains, particularly relevant and particularly important to the state's case. It's the only evidence they had of any sort of deep-seated anger, morbidity, resentment that the defendant might have harbored that would have created these feelings of paranoia. so that they couldn't subject him to a psychological analysis there. I don't know of any, and I haven't spoken to the trial attorneys, whether there are any other incidents in which he manifested that sort of behavior. If it did, it would have had a whole bunch of problems under 404B, 604. It would have been difficult to put in, but I'm unaware of any evidence that way, one way or the other. It was basically the only evidence the state had to suggest, at least, that there was something behind, some motive behind, an otherwise totally inexplicable, literally inexplicable crime.
The reason I ask that, what I would think that the strength of your motive argument directly affects his self-defense argument, which is his motive for acting.
I beg your pardon. I think what most undermines his self-defense argument is the fact that he didn't say anything to anybody. Never once does he bring it forward. And in fact, he tells several of the state's witnesses, several of his friends, Nickerson, Benavides, I think he also said it to White, I don't remember what happened. I think I killed some people. I think I may have shot some people. Even has to ask one of them, did it look like they were going to rob me? Did you think they were going to rob me? And I think that strongly suggests that it's a defense sort of created looking back, shall we say. But there are evidence of the motive was relevant, and yes, the fact that he may have been suffering under some sort of paranoid delusion would explain a lot. Would explain
why you're kind of arguing that he's paranoid, delusional, but he's not reporting what he just did. Well, if he was in a clear mind, then that undermines your delusional argument, and would enhance why if he's clear, then he should have reported it. But if he's paranoid, delusional, maybe that's why he didn't record it.
The state maintained that it was the paranoid delusion was a result of the alcohol and methamphetamine consumption, and that presumably he would have sobered up by when he spoke to White, depending on the timeline you use, it would have been 5 to 6 hours. When he talked to Nickerson and Benavides, it would have been anywhere from 8 to 12 hours.
Okay,
Chip, I've got a question. You've got the defense of property. And no longer is there a duty to retreat as far as self-defense. What about defense of property?
I think the same argument as to why the
you have to be threatened to defend your property.
You have to be what? I'm sorry.
You have to feel that your life is threatened in order to defend your property in your home.
No, but I think you have to have a reasonable belief that they're stealing something. Was the same as the reasonable belief that they're threatening your life. And the state would maintain under the circumstances in this case, he never reported that he thought he was being robbed, and that's why he did it. Moreover, I take a little, I'm not going to go into every inconsistency and everywhere where I disagree with the defense's interpretation of the evidence. Nevertheless, there is the only evidence that anything had been moved, that anything might have been taken, that they were even remotely considered robbing him was from the defendant himself, from appellant. And the jury, as I sort of harkening back to, could have rejected that simply because they didn't find him credible. The only thing that it had been moved, according to him, by the way, was the rifle. He did testify that he thought he'd seen a backpack that had been opened, but I guess if you call that move, then he moved. They moved something else. But there was no other evidence that anything had been radically rearranged in the house to give him cause to think that they were somehow packing up everything and about to move it out. So the state would maintain that belief that he was about to be robbed was not reasonable under the circumstances.
The jury hung up on the Capitol.
Yes, ma'am.
So. At least some of the jury bought the self-defense as to the person who came into the bedroom?
Perhaps they rejected it because they didn't think it was the same criminal transaction, which was part of the charge, I believe. And they may have had a disagreement on that. They may not have understood it. I mean, I don't think we can say definitively why. And moreover, the Court of Criminal Appeals has repeatedly held that we don't speculate on why jurors may go with lessers than greaters. And indeed, that's why we submit every lesser that the defense is entitled to, because they may skip down. It may be the one thing they can all agree on without great debate the reasons are myriad.
My question was, because I frankly didn't think to look at the clerk's record. What happened to that capital? Was he acquitted? Was there a judgment of acquittal entered as to the capital, or
what happened to them?
Did it just?
Well, because he was found guilty on the lesser, and they ended up entering on the punishment. I believe they're jeopardy barred now. But had they not been, then they all would have been mistried, and we would have come back and retried it again, which goes to the state's point that there was a mistake in the charge. Barrows calls not putting the correct language in, not putting the instruction in the jury charge that, hey, if you get hung up on the greater, you can go ahead and go to those. They say it's inartful, and the court also says that it would be the better practice to include that. The reason they don't call it error is because that issue wasn't before the court. The issue before the court in Barrows was whether the court was required to instruct the jury that they have to reach a verdict on the greater before they go to the lesser. They must either acquit or find him guilty. And the court said, no, it's not required at all. What the state would suggest is if you reject the argument that taken in its totality, the jury's last note to the court was not some sort of question, what do we do, what now? In the alternative, the state would maintain that at least for purpose, the state would further maintain that the Court of Criminal Appeals has made it clear that when the court becomes aware of an error in the charge while it's before the jury, the court can take steps to correct that. I think Robertson, the court even says that the juror's question alerted the judge to the problem in the charge. So what the state would maintain now is that at least under Barrows, when this sort of thing occurs, at least for the purposes of 3616 and the submission of a supplemental charge, that the failure to include that language is erroneous, i.e., it would be absurd and a waste of judicial resources, jurors' time, judges' time, a second juror's time, to not submit that language and at least see if the jury can come to a verdict on the lessers, and instead declare a mistrial as to all the charges simply because they're hung up on the first one. And that's... I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I didn't even notice.
I'll need to ask.
In essence, that's just the case. We're not asking for a full extension of Barrows, that it absolutely has to be required in every circumstance. But when it comes to the court's attention that the sort of situation that arose in this case occurs again, that the court is authorized under Barrows and those line of cases to say a judge can correct errors in the charge to do so. As to appellant's argument about waiver, I would point out that Amanza and all the cases since then have held, yes, ma'am. It's ultimately up to the judge to get the charge right. And while waiver can factor into it, and waiver factors into the harm analysis under Almanza, it doesn't absolve the court of the responsibility to get the charge right. And it doesn't mean that one party can claim the other party didn't point the error out, and therefore they should get the benefit of that error. I will rely on the state's brief on the second point of error. It was inartfully drafted. I'll adopt his phrase. But
we're not cutting you off. We're not going to let you go. We got more questions.
Really don't have anything to add. The defense does point out one point. The state's analysis in the second point of error isn't as full as I would have wished. And I would simply add that at least as the second of the criteria to evaluate the 403, the potential to impress in some irrational yet indelible way, the state's argument was not as full as it should have been. What we would emphasize is that the nature of the evidence, there's little chance of impressing the jury in some irrational yet indelible way. It doesn't paint him as a racist. It doesn't paint him as a fanatic. It doesn't paint him as somebody so far out of the mainstream that this is someone who, regardless of whether he may or may not be guilty, should be somehow locked up and would tempt the jury to take out a verdict against them on some improper basis.
Wilkinson, would you please get your brief? I want to ask you about it. Look at page 33. There's a summary about testimony from Christina Reed.
Yes, sir.
What evidence is there that at the time of this event that Mr. Kirk had any evidence in his bloodstream or otherwise about the use of either amphetamine or methamphetamine?
Defendant admitted to repeated amphetamine use on cross-examination. I believe it was on cross-examination. Furthermore, the Karen Crumley, the Tarrant County jailer who interviewed him, indicated that he began to ask questions, and when she got to a question about methamphetamine use, he refused to answer.
Well, so the answer to my question is that there's no evidence that he was had used recently or been involved with the use of either amphetamine or methamphetamine at the time of these events.
There's no direct evidence, yes, Your Honor.
All right.
The state would maintain, if I may.
Go ahead. I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
You're saying, look, he admitted to past use, and past use might affect his mental capacities and the way that he might perceive of some of the things that he testified about in having fear in his mind.
Correct, but the state would suggest even further that his denial of his refusal to answer the question on the methamphetamine use, like a refusal to take a DWI test, would imply that he actually had used methamphetamine recently. Same sort of theory they use in DWI cases.
All right, then let's talk about alcohol for a moment. What evidence was there in the case? I know he admitted that he'd been drinking all night, not all night, but at least from 4:30 in the afternoon or 5:30. And we know that the two victims had blood alcohol levels in their vitreous of their eyes, one of 0.324 on page 19 of your brief, and the other one .399, 4 and 5 times legal limits to be drunk.
Yes, Your Honor.
What evidence did we have or in terms of direct testimony or evidence about what was the status of Mr. Kirk's blood level of alcohol at the time of these events?
Appellant admitted that he had been drinking a number of beers. Benavides also testified that by his estimation, let me see if I can find it exactly.
I believe
it was around 10 beers.
I saw that.
Before he left, before 1 o'clock. After that, we don't know how much they may or may not have been drinking.
I understand.
According to appellant's testimony,
So there's evidence by the state's contention that he did have alcohol use, and he didn't deny that.
Yes, Your Honor, there is. There were admissions by the appellant himself, and there's testimony by Benavides at least that she'd seen him. And I believe Thompson testified that she saw them drinking as well.
Yes, that's what I said. There is evidence that he was drinking heavily.
Yes, Your Honor.
How would that impact one's clarity of memory the next morning and the next day of the actual events that occurred and all of the timing of the things that are brought to point on the time frame advanced by the state as being that he really wasn't being truthful when he was talking about a 1 o'clock time frame for Mr. Benavides leaving and not arriving at Ms. Thompson's house until 5 o'clock the next morning?
It very well may have affected his memory. That goes to the weight of the evidence, and that's for the jury to determine. The jury, by its verdict, rejected that.
In terms of the evidence on point of error number two, was there any evidence that Mr. Kirk had no previous convictions?
There were no evidence. No, none admitted at this trial, no. I don't know about the first trial. I haven't read the record.
So the conduct and the drinking of the alcohol and the possibility that he had at some time in the past used amphetamine or methamphetamine were the two negative things about him as far as just his status of mind or character or other things that might be involved in the jury's evaluation of his credibility.
Were those the only things?
No, those were two things.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then what our standard is in looking at the impact, possible impact of any error that might have been created in the use of prejudicial evidence.
I'm sorry, you have to repeat the question.
Point of error number two.
Uh-huh.
All this evidence about the things that were over at his other house.
Yes.
Were so prejudicial that they shouldn't have been admitted. That's point of error two, you understand?
Yes, sir.
And therefore, if we have no motive except to try to explain, I mean, we don't have a motive other than self-defense, indirect evidence in the trial, and that all comes from his testimony.
Yes.
And no other evidence whatsoever about what occurred in the house after 1 o'clock, as far as Mr. Benavides' testimony, that that's when he left.
Yes.
So what happened in terms of the actual event is strictly a matter of then piecing together the circumstantial evidence of the time frame of his conduct and his statements and what he did and what he didn't do about making comments about the people. But we do have evidence that he made comments to Mr. White whenever they were going into the house. How could I have done this? How could I have this have happened?
I believe
so
he told...
What my whole concern, where I'm going with this, is without the evidence of the things that were in the photographs at his old residence, that was the one of the other and main things in terms of evidence for the jury to evaluate in looking at his credibility. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So the state takes the position that those things were really not very important in the trial because they only took 9 minutes out of 6-8 volumes, however many, and defense counsel concedes it's 4 volumes. But we get around to looking at the evaluation and matters that the courts have given us to look at in terms of measuring the prejudice. That is something that's very troubling to me.
There are alternative arguments, Your Honor. The state's primary argument is that this trial court did not err in admitting the evidence over a Rule 403 objection, that it was, as you suggest, highly relevant, highly pertinent, very important to the state's case. And when you do the 403 analysis using the 4 criteria, that all those weigh in favor of admitting it. If the court did not err in overruling the 403 objection, there is no error, and therefore we don't get to a harmless error analysis. If, on the other hand, this court concludes that the court did err and should have sustained the Rule 403 objection, the state's alternative argument is, well, you've obviously weighed these criteria against it. You've deemed that it wasn't very important to the state's case, that it perhaps, you know, it may have taken up too much time, and that's why he should have overruled it, et cetera, et cetera. If this court concludes that, then the state would argue, well, if that's what this court has concluded, then those arguments will also weigh in favor of finding the error harmless in the totality of the case. I'm not suggesting it's one or the other. What the state's suggesting is it's either or. Either this court did not err, and the criteria under 403 all weigh or substantially weigh in the state's favor, and there is no error, or we go to a harmless error analysis in which the state maintains that these particular pieces of evidence were not such that they removed the jury from a state of non-persuasion to persuasion beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard of harmless error.
So it would be the state's position that as we are a reviewing court in asking if there was a reasonable probability that the error, either alone or in context, moved the jury from a state of non-persuasion to one of persuasion as to the issue in question, that that did not occur in this case. The prejudicial evidence argued by the defense under 403 being the photographs of the things that were in the place he was moving out of.
If you believe the defendant's testimony, which the jury, by its verdict, did not, then yes, arguably it could be harmful. The jury rejected that. Moreover, I would also take issue with your characterization of White's testimony. He testified that when the defendant showed up at his doorstep, he was very evasive, said he couldn't remember, wasn't really sure what went on. When he got to the house, they went in. When appellant went back and found the bodies, he stated, "I can't believe I did this," not "I can't believe this happened" or something to that effect. And the state would maintain that the difference is significant. He never let on to White all the way over that he believed he'd been attacked, that he feared that he'd been robbed, that he had had to act in self-defense, or anything like that. Moreover, once he found the bodies, he didn't do anything either. So the state would maintain that's far more persuasive evidence as to whether he actually acted in self-defense or not than evidence of motive. And I would also point out the state's not required to prove motive beyond a reasonable doubt, so that the state could maintain that it needs this evidence and this evidence should be admitted for the purposes of establishing motive, but the level of the evidence doesn't have to rise to the level of proving motive beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
Thank you.
I've got a question. If someone is in your home and you tell them to leave and they refuse, how far can you go because you no longer have to retreat? How far can you go to get them out of your house? That's part A.
Is that all?
Part B is, does it make a difference that you invite them into your house rather than wake up and find them standing over your bed?
I'll answer your second question first because it's far easier. Yeah, it does make a difference because in your second scenario, if you've invited them into the house, do you mean if they invited the house and you ask them to leave?
Yes.
Or if you just invite them to the house,
you invite them to the house and then you ask them to leave and they don't leave.
I don't think it makes a difference for purposes of charging with, say, burglary, or, you know, if they then threaten you and are going to take something, it would rise to the level of robbery. But as Justice McCoy pointed out, under 9.31, what do we say, C, burglary is not one of the listed offenses for which you can use deadly force. It has to be robbery or aggravated robbery. So the fact that they may or may not have been on the premises means they may or may not have been committing the offense of burglary, but it doesn't go to the issue of whether he properly used self-defense in that situation. That's your second question. Your first question, I honestly don't know the answer to that one. I think it would largely depend on the facts and circumstances of the case. But under the defense of self-defense and the use of deadly force, you can't use the use of deadly force unless, and I forget all the buzzwords, it's to save yourself or prevent the other side from using, the deadly force against you. So regardless of what other actions he could have taken or should have taken, the state would maintain he couldn't shoot them unless they were threatening to use deadly force against him.
And their forces against and their threats against him were.
He claimed that they had said, "We're going to fuck you up, we're going to teach you a lesson." Yeah. Words to that effect. He never testified that they physically, verbally threatened him with physical harm, and certainly he never testified that they verbally threatened to kill him. It's not anywhere in the record. What the defendant maintained at trial when he testified was that he believed that the testimony is a little inconsistent. What he said is they went outside, he got in an argument with them because he said, if there's anything missing, I'm going to call the police. They yelled back at him, oh, you don't know who you're messing with. You know, we have friends. They chase him back into the house. And he testifies they are so close on his heels that he can't even close the front door. He can't bar them from coming into the house. He runs back to the bedroom and goes in the closet and gets his gun. Then he testifies they sort of apparently mill around out in the living room area. He can hear them there, and they're shouting things at him. He doesn't testify what they're shouting, the specifics of it. But they stop there. Then he testifies he fires two or three warning shots. He testified to one number, and they only found a certain number of bullet holes in the ceiling, which sort of contradicted it. Exactly. I think it was he claimed four, and they found three. It's possible the other one went out somewhere else. He fires them into the ceiling. Then, because he said he was afraid that they went back into the other room and got the handguns that were there, handguns, by the way, that the police later found zippered in a zippered suitcase. Anyway, he believes because they may have gone back and found the handguns, he leaped out of the closet, still in the bedroom, back in the far back corner of the bedroom, in line with the door down in the hallway, jumped out, kneeled down, and fired off some shots at both men. Although he later told White he didn't know whether he'd aimed at him or not. But at trial, he says, well, I shot him. I was aiming at him. He drops the one who was closest and almost in the doorway was not Diaz, Alfonso Beza. He falls down. They find a beer can by his hands stretched out like this, and they find a beer can about 2 or 3 feet away, which, as the state suggested, it's highly, and because of the vitreous alcohol level in his eye, The ME testified that he had probably been drinking very, very recently before he was killed because of the difference between that and the blood alcohol level. The state would maintain as a reasonable inference that he was walking, perhaps running, down the hall with a beer can in his hand, which much undercuts the allegation that they were somehow threatening him and coming in here to do him bodily or deathly harm.
Or could have been mistaken for a firearm.
Well, he could.
To a drunk?
They didn't argue this at trial. My theory is they heard the gunshots and they were going down to see what had happened.
Okay.
But in any case, it's a reasonable inference that he had a beer can in his hand. The other man is further on down the hall, and appellant's attorney has suggested that he was coming out of the south bedroom, southeast bedroom, where the handguns had been held. But there was also an entrance into the kitchen right off of there. So it's just as likely that he'd come around from the kitchen where the defendant even claimed to have seen him earlier in the evening. The state would maintain very little evidence that they, direct evidence that they threatened with any sort of death or bodily, you know, serious bodily injury.
Any other questions?
No, thank you.
All right, we'll let
you go. State
prays
for an affirmance.
Okay, Gary, sir.
Just briefly, Your Honor, I just want to be clear about the self-defense statute. The statute's hard and confusing when you try to read through it. But when we're talking about murder or robbery, what we're talking about there is there's a provision of the self-defense statute where your use of deadly force is presumed to be reasonable if the person is attempting to commit one of those enumerated offenses. But that's not the only time you can use self-defense. You can use self-defense when you have a reasonable belief that the use of deadly force is immediately necessary to protect yourself against the other's use or attempted use of deadly force. So he had a reasonable belief that they were robbing him. He had a reasonable belief that they may be attempting to murder him, but he certainly had a reasonable belief that they were using unlawful deadly force against him. There was never an issue in this case about duty to retreat. Because they're obviously under the circumstances here, there was no opportunity to retreat. So the Castle Doctrine applies in one sense and doesn't apply in another sense, because what the Castle Doctrine really does, it excuses you from having to exercise a duty to retreat. But it doesn't matter in this case because there was no place to retreat to, and it was an immediate, from what Mr. Kirk said, they were coming at him, and he had no opportunity to retreat. One last comment about the evidence of the things at his house. And the state does emphasize that they don't have to prove motive, but what's different about this case is that the state's theory as to why he would have killed them really doesn't make sense. And that's why they wanted to put that evidence in of the things at his house, just to make the jury think, well, maybe he's a demon worshiper. Maybe he collects skulls. Maybe there's something weird about this guy. It's clearly inadmissible, and it's clearly important to the state's case because it fills in or attempts to fill in this gaping hole in their case, which is the fact that they don't have a theory or an argument as to why he did this. And this is an unusual case where the defendant's theory and explanation makes a whole lot more sense than the state's. And that's why they needed that evidence. If there's no other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your coming back to argue and answering all our questions. Your case is submitted. You are finally free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.